And first of all, we have three bills to hear, and so we'll start with Senate Bill 146.
Okay. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Senate Bill 146 increases the membership and modifies the duties of the Mental Health Advisory Board. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are three or four people here in the audience.
Yes, I see.
I didn't know whether you wanted them to be a group at the table or you wanted to have them come up after I made my opening remarks.
Well, Marianne Barnhart, are you? Where are you? Oh, would you come up, please?
Yeah.
And we'll start. And then Kathy, would you also come up? And then we have Bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Morris.
Bill will come up. And maybe, Kathy, if you and Bill sit behind for just a minute, we have these spots here, and then you can come up next. Okay. Anne, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Morissette and members of the committee. I'm Anne Brand, Administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in the Department of Human Services. Senate Bill 146 merges two longstanding advisory boards, the Mental Health Advisory Board and the Mental Health Planning and Management Advisory Council. I'm here to testify in support of SB 146. Prior to the 2001 reorganization of the Department of Human Services, the Mental Health Advisory Board advised the administrator of the former Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Division. The Mental Health Planning and Management Advisory Council advised the then Office of Mental Health Services on the planning, allocation, and utilization of resources for mental health service delivery statewide. The Mental Health Planning and Management Advisory Council is required by Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, to review and monitor Oregon's federal block grant for mental health services. SB 146 eliminates an outdated board, although very valuable during its years of service, and clarifies the statutory responsibilities for public input into the policymaking and operations of state mental health. The Mental Health Advisory Board is supportive of this concept and has written a letter to former Governor Kitzhaber to ask for the change. I thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on SB 146. I would be happy to answer any questions, and there are members of that board, both in its prior configuration and current configuration, who are here to respond to questions also.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions at this time?
Just quickly.
Okay.
Ms. Brand, they're deleting the appointment of members to the committees and the approval of the governor.
My understanding is that the former governor was supportive of this move, but I don't know about the current governor. Maybe the members of the committee might be able to respond to you on that one.
I guess the question I would have is wouldn't it be prudent to have the approval of the governor, because by implication the governor is then engaged in the discussion regarding the issue. I mean, maybe they would be anyway. I don't know.
Would you like to respond to that, or?
Okay. Would you come up and identify yourself, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Lieberman. I'm a member of the Mental Health Planning and Management Advisory Council. I'm Executive Director of Southern Oregon Adolescent Study and Treatment Center in Grants Pass, and currently President of a State Association of Intensive Treatment Services, which is called CHARP, Child and Adolescent Residential Psychiatric Programs. I've been a member of the council for, 8 or 9 years now. I chaired it previously. I was in some of the discussions in the drafting of this bill regarding the question that Senator Minnis raises, whether or not the appointment should come from the governor. And I believe that most members of the council would not see this as a major issue one way or the other, but I can inform you that in those discussions, it was felt that with the size of the new council that's being recommended here, that's of a sufficient size and scope that it may be too much a level of detail for a governor or governor's staff to look at. I know there were members of the group that was drafting this that thought that a gubernatorial appointment would elevate the importance of this group, and there were others who felt that pragmatically perhaps this was the best way to proceed.
Finance Committee. Further questions?
Others.
Thank you. I guess I do have one question out of curiosity. The six advocates, who are the advocates of the men? What categories are the advocates? Are these?
Could I speak to them?
Yes, please. Come up and identify yourself, Kathy.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cappy Eaton. I have served as chair of the Mental Health Advisory Board before it was dissolved, and I serve on the Planning Council as an advocate. I'm on the council, while I'm not formally a representative of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, because of the League's interest in the fact that we do lobby on mental health issues, have done studies, research, and have a position, I advocate on behalf of both AAUW and the League for issues in mental health, and therefore I am appointed to the council as an advocate.
Do we know who the other advocates to group? If you'd identify yourself, please.
Chairman Morris, I'm Mariana Bornhold. I'm a member of the Mental Health Planning and Management Advisory Council. I'm also a commissioner with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. NAMI is represented.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay, good. I just wanted to get a sense of who the advocacy groups were. Okay, very good. Marianne, did you have testimony?
Chair Morissette, members of the council, as I've said before, I'm Mariana Bornhold, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services to support the passage of Senate Bill 146. As Dr. Brandt has told you, it creates a single umbrella oversight agency for programs of OMHAS, the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addictions. Such a board as would provide for citizen participation, policy decisions, and evaluation of both state and federally funded mental health programs and services. Specified representation includes families, caregivers, advocates, consumers, and seniors, with special emphasis on children's mental health issues, as well as state agency representatives. The Commission does have one concern about the present proposed bill, which relates to membership. It specifies 43 members plus 5 non-voting members, which represent state agencies. To us, particularly in the days of a constricted budget, it seems to be a very cumbersome and expensive number of persons charged with meeting regularly for deliberations. At this size, far exceeds the number of persons specified by federal statute. If you look on the back of the statement, you'll see the requirements from Title 19 of the Public Health Service. And we feel that as proposed, citizen participation is outweighed by state agency representation, which we feel has the potential of compromise in the oversight role of the board. At present, the commission is represented in PAMA's membership, and we are the only voice for older Oregonians in this body. We join other advocates and consumers in seeking citizen representation on the new Mental Health Advisory Board, equal to that of those from state agencies in order to be effective. We hope that you will address our concerns before passing Senate Bill 146 out to vote. In addition to the statement from the Commission, I was asked to draft a suggested reduced membership, which is on a separate sheet, which meets statutory requirements and still, I think, provides balanced representation. Thank you for your attention. I'll be glad to answer any questions. Okay,
thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. President, or Mr. Chair.
Oh, you can call me that.
At least I didn't downgrade you in bulk state. Man, I appreciate what you're saying because I was just going through that same thing in mind, and I see over here on our guide to the bill that it indicates that there's no fiscal impact, and I'm sitting here saying, how in the world can't there be a fiscal impact to this thing if you're going to go from a maximum of 20 up to 48, and if you're going to meet every other month instead of every quarter, that's two more meetings. So to me it indicates that there's going to be expenses for something fairly considerable to the amount of money that had been spent in the past. So I would second your testimony there that I think that it should be looked in a bit from that standpoint, and also a bit from the actual unwieldiness of the that amount of people.
It's been difficult to get a quorum with the membership that size, sir.
Okay. Thank you. I'm looking in here somewhere where the only people who will be paid are the family members and the individuals who are...
Mr. Chair, it's not a matter of the pay. There's overnight expenses. There's travel expenses.
No. Okay.
All of these groups come with basically furnished an overnight if they're very far distant, and obviously these are going to be people chosen from all over the state.
Okay.
And I've been on several of these committees, and yes, there may not be any pay actually for the folks that are there, but there is expenses of the meeting room, the lunch or dinner that's provided with it, and so forth.
Okay, maybe we need to take some time to look into this.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, we would be happy to go back and do a more precise fiscal analysis of this and look at the membership as has been suggested.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem with the tenor of the bill as a whole, but I did question the fact that, you know, normally we do get a fiscal impact of something like this. And
well, I think that's important that we...
No, we didn't on this particular issue. And I thank Mariana for bringing it to our attention, too.
Okay. Other testimony that you wish to give?
I'm finished. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Bill and Kathy, would you come up, please?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I am a citizen involved with mental health issues. I first became involved this way when I was appointed to the Lane County Mental Health Advisory Board in 1964. I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 146 today. It revises the current statute to the state's Mental Health Advisory Board. I did want to comment about the expenses before I get into this. For the majority of us, we receive no reimbursement for attending the members of the council meetings. What is provided is a room and usually some coffee service for us. There are special arrangements that have been made for consumer members who would need special attention, but we have, the old advisory board did receive mileage, and we met quarterly. The council, however, meets every other month, and we receive no reimbursement for mileage or meals. The only expenses that I'm aware of, except for the consumers and family members that may receive something toward their attendance. The rest of us do not attend at any cost to the state. I just wanted to clarify that.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Now, when you say members, what do you mean members? You mean the people from the state?
Members of the Planning and Management Council.
And you come and stay all night on your own?
No, I don't. Our meetings are from 8:30 in the morning until noon.
And where do you live in?
I live in Eugene. And I've been on that council since 1995 when it was organized, and I've never received any mileage for it or any expenses at all. But I do know that if it's a hardship for members, consumer members, there is provision which the Office of Mental Health Services has provided to that group. I also, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit more in my testimony, Moni, but every state has a planning council as required by the federal law to receive the block grant money, over which this Planning and Management Council, it has the oversight for it, and the council is constituted by federal law. Most other councils in other states, some have expenses that are covered for their council meetings and council activities, and that money, Bob Lieberman and I have both, and I believe Bill also, we've attended national meetings where the representatives of other councils have been there. And there is money allocated under the block grant itself by the state to pay for activities of the council. We have never had that kind of expenses unless those, and I would have to ask Dr. Brand about that, unless our every other monthly meeting room costs and coffee service are covered under administration of the block grant. But those are the only expenses that I know of. We have sought to discuss this with the Office of Mental Health Services in the past, feeling that there are some activities which the council would like to be involved with, which might have advantages for the state, should there be some expense money, but we have never had any as a council.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Fisher.
Well, I guess I'm concerned about that because I'm guessing you have your meetings around Salem.
We always meet in Salem, yes.
So Eugene is not a bad drive from Salem.
No.
Roseburg isn't too much further, but about twice the drive. Boy, you start getting over, you're going to have people from very southern Oregon, from eastern Oregon, and weather conditions and things like that. You're talking about overnight stays, almost two nights, because realistically, and especially people if they do have disabilities, or whether they be mental or physical or a combination of both, it's going to be very, very difficult for them to drive one way even in the same day that they hold a meeting. And it almost precludes anyone, unless they're pretty wealthy, to be able to make that kind of without some kind of help. And I commend you for what's been done in the past, but it would seem to me here that there's going to be some need for help if you're going to have it spaced out around the state so that we get fair representation from all parts of the state and things like that. We're also interested in the fiscal situation for other entities, not just the state, and if they're coming from other councils and places like that where they've got money, someone has to pay that bill, and I guess that's what I was curious about, because if you haven't been having any monies for that, and all of a sudden you have to pay the family members and the other people that are consumers and things like that that are coming, then we certainly are going to have expenses we haven't had in the past, or somebody's got to pull the money out of somewhere, and I guess that's what my concern was. I see a hand back there now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, as I indicated, we have in the past recommended to the director that there be some monies allocated from the block grant to cover expenses for the council. And that's one of the suggestions that I'm making as an addendum to the bill that's before you. So I'm not arguing that there should be no fiscal impact, but if the pattern of other councils in other states is followed, that's where money has come for activities of those councils has been out of the block grant money that's used for administration. So I think there is a revenue stream that could be identified to pay for that. And I certainly understand if we're going to start to reimburse council members and get a better representation around the state, that you really do need to look at that. But I'm sure that Dr. Brand can provide those kinds of figures for you.
Okay.
Can I continue?
Yes, continue. Yes.
The public law, which established the Planning and Management Council, did specify who should serve on that council. And those entities or individuals are identified in the revision in Senate Bill 146, which you have in front of you. And the Planning and Management Council concurred with the Mental Health Advisory Board in recommending to the governor 2 years ago with the dissolution of the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. That the Planning and Management Council be in fact designated in the revision of the statute as the mental health advisory group for the state. The council is required by law, and the main concern is mental health, so it seems appropriate, at least to me, that it should be the successor to the Mental Health Advisory Board. Members of the council discussed the elements that they felt were important to include in the revision of the Mental Health Advisory Board. For the most part, Senate Bill 146 incorporates the points put forward by the council related to the membership and purpose of that group. Speaking only for myself and not for the council, it would be helpful to have your committee discuss the following issues expressed by the council but not incorporated into the revised statute and which are less suited for inclusion in OARs. First, to provide for expenses of the council, other than from consumers and family members, to be used for such activities as an annual planning retreat, as a member of a mental health program office county program site visit to assess the block grant funds, as membership in the National Association of Mental Health Planning Councils. These types of activities are funded by most other states from the block grant portion for administration, as I indicated before. Secondly, to continue the practice of allowing the council to discuss and nominate potential council members to the director when vacancies occur. Members are an excellent source of suggestions. Third, to allow the council to establish operating bylaws to conduct its business without the necessity for putting them in rules. These would include such items as chairs and vice chairs, quorum requirements, representation and voting privileges in case of absence, etc. And finally, to allow the council to meet every month during the legislative session, which has been our practice for the last two sessions. It is important that the Office for Mental Health and Addiction Services have an advisory board of members who are deeply interested in the state's mental health system. Senate Bill 146 can preserve an existing body already dedicated to a client-oriented mental health system, as well as to the purposes of the federal block grant. I thank you for this opportunity to express my support and to add my comments to the discussion.
Thank you. Okay, I guess we'll move on with the testimony, and Bob, would you mind stepping up and addressing some of these concerns?
Members of the council, my name is Senator Morissette, Chair. My name is Bill Willard. I am Executive Director of the Child Center, a psychiatric day treatment program located in Springfield, Oregon, and currently the co-chair of the Mental Health Planning Advisory Council that has been referred to in earlier testimony. I'm here today speaking as a member of the council. I'm not here speaking on behalf of the council. I am in support of this bill, Senate Bill 146. The bill reflects discussions that we have occurred in the past several months between members of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, the Mental Health Advisory Board, and the Mental Health Planning Advisory Council. In effect, this bill provides for the consolidation of Mental Health Planning Management Advisory Council with the Mental Health Advisory Board, hopefully making this system more efficient. In support of this action, the Mental Health Planning and Management Advisory Council on December 12, 2002, adopted as a goal to continue our effort to establish council statutorily and act as the principal umbrella mental health advisory group of the mental health system. We have also identified three objectives, supporting the completion of this goal, which is in part why I'm here today. The effect of this bill would reduce the number of DHS advisory boards, which I believe, again, in this economic times is a good thing, increase system efficiency, provide for budget allocation for support services to the board, permits per diem reimbursement for volunteer board members, provides Oregon provide Oregon statutory authority while the advisory council, which the advisory council lacks today. And we feel give the council or board greater credibility. Clearly, there are times when less is more, but combining the advisory council and the board, I feel this action will provide greater benefits for all involved, whether it be consumers, advocates, providers, or state officials. Again, for the reasons stated above, I'm here to support Senate Bill 146. One quick thing of clarity. The membership that is prescribed here in Senate Bill 146 reflects the current membership of the Planning Advisory Council. These aren't expanded or, you know, it's not like we're adding 30 to this group. This group exists. This group meets every other month. And so we already have this in place, and it's already ongoing.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to have you explain a little more about the two boards. I don't find in here where it talks about a combining. Missing something?
Yeah. In fact, what this bill does, we have two separate boards now. The Mental Health Planning Board, which Cappy alluded to that she was chair of, and the current Mental Health Planning Advisory Council, which is in place due to Public Law 102-321. When the state received block grants, it's mandated if we're going to receive block grants that we have this Planning Management Advisory Council in place per PL 102-321. We also have a Mental Health Advisory Board. The two groups were talking a lot about the same thing and addressing the same issues, and it seemed to us that it was duplicating of efforts. And so we have long been talking about why not combine the two groups, why make it a more efficient system, why have two meetings and we can have one, why address these same issues more than once. And so we have been discussing amongst ourselves the wisdom of possibly combining the two groups. So basically what will happen is the Planning Advisory Management Council will then become the Mental Health Advisory Board. And so though it looks like that board is expanding by large numbers, what you're actually doing is just shifting one board or one committee into another, and one instead of two.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Is this, and I hear it referred to on page 2, line 32, says require the board to fulfill federal mandates for state mental health planning councils.
Yes.
But it doesn't say anything at all about that there is a planning council out there that this is combining. Now, what statutory authority, if any, do we have for the planning council?
Senator Morrison, Vice Chair Senator Fisher, as I understand it, federal law requires if you receive block grants that this council exists, but it does not appear in the Oregon state statutes. And that's why we feel, in part, by combining this with the mental health advisory, which is statutorily supported, then basically become recognized statutorily, both at the federal level and at the state level.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
Then what is the amount of people serving on the, let me get this, the Health Planning Council, how many,
on the,
and what is their budget?
The Mental Health Planning and Advisory Council, by bylaws, their membership is reflected here in the first page of Senate Bill 146. These folks, where it says 6 consumers, 6 advocates, mental health services, 8, that is what is in the bylaws of the existing Planning Management Council. So they've taken the membership role out and put it into this bill. So you have the same membership. The only real difference is it becomes more specified when we talk about, I believe it's 5 members. The director is to appoint the following persons as non-voting members, where they talk about the superintendent. That is a little more prescribed than it is in the bylaw.
Okay, further question? Any further questions?
I just have one. One little clarification here. So, pardon me, this first 6 consumers, 6 advocates, 8 family members, and
yes,
6 representatives,
yes,
those are all of the advisory planning?
Yes, they are.
Plan?
Yes.
And they are not part of this 20, up to 20, that were in the actual original board?
They are part of the Planning Council. I am not sure, and Kathy could speak to what the membership is of the Mental Health Advisory Board itself. I'm not sure. I didn't sit on that board, so I'm not sure what the membership of that board is.
And there were no other state agencies or anything like that of people that were on the planning.
Yes, they are. They are. We have people there from the Department of Ed. We have people there from SCF. We have people there from the Mental Health Division. Senior Services, yes.
And they would be incorporated in the rest of these groups,
yep.
The 10 representatives and that, so forth.
Yeah, again, the bylaws for the Planning Council represents the exact same membership listed here. So it's just basically shifting that over into the advisory.
Okay, Bob is the cleanup batter here, so.
And I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm probably going to be repeating what.
Identify yourself one more.
I'm sorry, but for the record, I'm Bob Lieberman. I'm a member of the Planning and Management Advisory Council, and I'm probably repeating what Bill has just been trying to clarify. Previously, there were two boards. One statutorily mandated in Oregon, a mental health advisory board. The other federally mandated, but the federal mandate does not require a state to put it into statute. It just says if you want block grant money, you have to have a planning and management council. So previously there were two committees. Between the two, they met 10 times a year. Membership overlapped, but not much. So you had 15 or 20 people meeting four times a year, and then you had the current representation of the council, which has been transported into this bill, meeting six times a year. What this bill does is condense it to one group with this current representation meeting six times a year. That's the effect of the bill. So it eliminates the other four meetings of 15 to 20 people each. And as we looked at that, we thought that was important, and it lines it up with federal statute. What's been important to me as a member of the council historically is that the legislature especially becomes aware of the existence of a group that is looking at the mental health system that has a sweeping federal mandate to monitor and evaluate the work in the mental health system in order to get the block grant money. It's got a very pretty sweeping charge from the federal government. But I've been concerned for many years as an individual member of the council, I'm not speaking for the council now, that I didn't think the legislature was aware that we even existed. That's probably true. So what's been important is that the importance of the council become elevated in the eyes of the legislature and the eyes of the governor, so that, and I think that actually will make it more attractive for people to participate and attend if they know that the results of our discussion and our recommendations end up every 2 years in some forum in front of the legislature. And that was part of the thinking behind this bill in mandating on the second page in Section 2 that there be the state mental health plan come through the council and be reported by the council to the legislature. Regarding payment, my provider association picks up the cost for me to attend from Grants Pass, and that's an expectation for everybody but consumers and family members, is that somehow they find the means to be to have their travel costs covered. And for my provider association, which is CHARP, that's a very reasonable cost, because I bring back information and I'm there then to represent intensive treatment services for children in psychiatric facilities to the council and represent those kinds of issues and discuss them there. So that's, most of these people are reimbursed that way. The fiscal impact then, without quantifying, without knowing exactly what the office has been paying, I presume would be less, because we have one board instead of two, we have four less meetings per year, we have 15 to 20 less people attending meetings, and the reimbursement to the consumers and families is something that the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services has already been providing previously. So I'm not imagining that there's an additional fiscal impact. I would love it if the legislature would find, see it fit to mandate some more financial support for the council. As an individual, I couldn't possibly ask the legislature to do that under the current circumstances when we're facing cuts in services. But I think as we look to the future, that I think that would be something we can look at. Is there some cost benefit to allocating money to the council for its activities? But again, as an individual, that's something that I personally would have a hard time advocating for. There's cuts in my agency that we're facing. So that's, I hope that clarifies things a little.
yield that.
Let me go to Senator.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Senator Minnis, you had a question.
Yeah, well, I have a series of questions, actually. I'm
then we'll come back.
Trying to understand what you're attempting to call. It's kind of a simple bill on the surface. You're just merging a couple of committees, and you're trying to move on and satisfy everybody and make sure you comply with federal law, et cetera, et cetera. First question, what public law is it we're trying to satisfy?
The number is public law 10.
Now, identify yourself again, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Again, my name is Bill Willard, currently co-chair of the Planning Management Council. Senator Domenech, the public law is PL 102-321. It has to deal with federal block grant funds.
All right, federal. And how much do we receive in federal block grant? Total aggregate number.
Senator Minnis, I can't give you that number off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
Yes.
And will the tape know who you are?
I'm so sorry. My name is Ann Brand, and probably given the timbre of my voice, I'll be unrecognizable. I'm the administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and I hesitate to give a ballpark figure at this point in time. I'm sorry.
$10? $20?
A couple million. I mean, it's in millions of dollars at this point, but it, relatively speaking, I can't off the top of my head.
In general, where do those dollars go?
They go to primarily counties and other programs to provide services that are not otherwise funded.
Okay, leads me to another question. Where are counties represented in this list of members?
In the membership on the Planning and Management Advisory Council. I don't have the list of members with me.
Well, is it line 22, the community mental health programs, or is that?
It would be line 22.
Is that what that's intended to be?
Yes, it is.
All right. Now, I guess I want to get back into this. I'd like the idea of paring down the membership, but I don't know if that's going to do damage to your constituent groups or members who may not be on the board if you pare it down. I happen to think that this is probably a pretty valuable function, and the cognizance of health issues is growing day by day here, as you know. And I'm trying to I guess understand what the relationship is between this particular organization and the management within DHR, and the relationship then to the governor. Because I guess my perception of the mental health system is it's pretty screwed up. You know, it's a dysfunctional system that's probably worse off than the criminal justice system. I mean, you know, at least we have courts and police and corrections, and it's pretty clearly identifiable who's who. But in mental health, it's pretty hard to discern who's really in charge or who's really the driving force in terms of public policy. And so, as a legislator, I agree, we need a higher level of understanding. I think that's why this committee exists, is to increase our knowledge level. So is it possible to perhaps work this bill over and try to really get to the heart of creating an entity that satisfies this public law, creates a workable membership that then produces something substantive? And this is why I get back into the relationship between the governor's office and DHR. We have fragmented pieces of mental health legislation that come into the legislature, and oftentimes it's hard to discern where it's coming from or how it fits into a comprehensive system of mental health and mental health policy in the state. So, and I sit up in chairing the Judiciary Committee, we held a hearing yesterday with folks from the Council of State Governments on the issue of mental health individuals who are in our prisons and jails, and it's a huge concern. To the extent that we want to get people who have mental health problems out of the jails and the mental health system, we have to clearly be able to identify a system that exists, and I'm afraid we can't do that very well. So I guess a series of questions mixed into dissertation, but I want to see if we can't make this thing substantive and productive and perhaps more workable.
Come on.
For the record, once again, I'm Bob Lieberman. Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, your questions are music to my ears, really, in the sense of I sit on other bodies in the state, including State Commission on Children and Families, and believe that there is... I've had concern, as I referenced earlier, and I'm speaking for myself, not for the council, not for the office. I've had concerns as a member of the council about the structural relationship between the council and the department and the governor and the legislature, feeling like we were missing opportunities and spinning some wheels in the bargain. And I've made those opinions quite clear to the council and to others. So I think the short answer to your question is that let me speak regarding representation. Again, I was in on the work group that was drafting the concepts, the legislative concepts for this bill. We did talk about the level of representation, and there was a feeling as this came out in this form that it was important to try to be inclusive and make sure there were representatives from all aspects of the mental health system. And that was what went into the thinking behind maintaining the current council representation, that's the way we would get the richness of the input. And that wasn't adding to the current representation. But regarding the structural relationship, I think there probably are a couple of things structurally that we can look at that are not huge, but would maybe increase the importance of the council and maybe put some requirements on the council for reporting to the legislature and to the governor in terms of what's going on in the mental health system. I believe there's a way to help the council serve an integrating function. That's what I'm getting at. And it's not something I think you can micromanage in a statute, but I think a statute can set the works in motion for that to occur.
Right. So kind of following up on that, I mean, I sometimes think out loud, but the opportunity perhaps to have a group like this, however it's constituted, to put together a list of suggested legislation. Now, and as I think about that, if we granted the power or directed them to come up with suggested legislation for the mental health system, that may conflict with DHR, or it may conflict with the governor, so there's a level of a lack of independence there. But if the legislature directed you to do that, notwithstanding the Department of Human Resources, notwithstanding other agencies, for me as a legislator, I like having independent opinions about, you know, what is wrong or what we need to do to change the system, because frankly I don't think we all have, none of us have a, you know, proprietary interest in or a silver bullet answer how to fix the thing.
Yes.
Bob Lieberman again, Mr. Chair, Senator Menace. Again, I think I'm very happy to be having this conversation. I think that's possible. I think it'd be important to make clear what the roles, responsibilities, auspices of the council were for all the members, so that it'd be clear kind of as it rolled out and people didn't overstep their bounds or see themselves as giving orders to the mental health, to the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And it could go sideways, but I do think it's possible to structure a relationship where the council could report to the legislature and could report to the governor and could receive directives from the legislature, such as advancing legislative concepts. And I can tell you that there, I don't think I'd be too far out on a limb in saying that if the legislature said, please give us some legislative concepts on this issue in the mental health system, we would have no problem having a quorum all at our own cost, except for the consumers and family members who really can't afford it, because that would bring out the county mental health directors and the provider representatives and the people who really feel like they have a stake if they knew the council was a place, a clearinghouse for thinking about legislative concepts at the wish of the legislature, that those issues of the quorum would kind of go away.
Senator Fisher, did you?
Yes. You know, obviously, as you explain this more thoroughly, sure, it makes considerably more sense than just a novice reading through the bill. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that I've asked the questions that I've asked, because I feel I have a much better handle on things, and it looks much different now than it did just at face glance. What I would question, Ms. Brand, I've been on the Governor's Commission for Senior Services for some time, and they're basically the only representation that the governor has in this committee or this board. And do you know yet whether the governor is going to have a little closer relationship with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services than we've had in the past? And if so, would it be better to have a direct representative from the governor's office on this, along with the governor's commission on senior services? I don't wish to leave the governor out. We have a new governor. We have a new page to start here. And knowing kind of what's gone on in the past, where in some cases we've almost been at odds with the governor's plans and things like that because of certain things that have happened in the past, which we don't wish to continue. At least I speak for myself as a member, not for the commission, but I think it's very, very important that the governor be included in these things. And if he will utilize, and if you know that he's going to utilize the governor's commission on senior services to provide that kind of assistance to his office, that's great.
Chair Morissette and Senator Fisher, I don't have an answer to that question yet. I just simply don't.
What we're going to do is we are going to hold this over. Senator Minnis has agreed to work with some of you on some solutions to this, and we will come back at another time to talk about it, and that will give you an opportunity to achieve the goals that you think need to be achieved. Okay? Good. Yes, Anne.
Thank you, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. I really appreciate this discussion and the opportunity to hear these points of view. This bill may be a vehicle for us to move the system forward in a number of ways, so appreciate it.
So the folks that would like to work, I'd like to keep it to a reasonably workable number of folks. But
about 48?
43.
I read a book one time, What They Didn't Teach in the Harvard Business School, and that was the extent that you were productive to the extent that you had no more than five people in a meeting, and it went exponentially downward after that. But if we can keep it reasonably small, and then if you contact my office, it's Senate 311, and talk to Holly Cooper, and she can see if we can set the place to have a meeting sometime.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, thank you.
I would have been more impressed if you said you read that, and what I've learned in kindergarten is what really works.
Yeah, I had
Harvard Business School.
I had problems in kindergarten.
Oh, kindergarten. Thank you all for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Close that public hearing, and we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 191.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Senate Bill 191 requires clinical laboratories that diagnose cases of cancer or benign tumors of brain and central nervous system to report that information to a statewide registry that will be housed at the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Well, we have four individuals who wish to speak, and Christy, would you come up, please? Okay, Donald Austin, why don't we do two and two? And please introduce yourselves. Christy, you want to start? Oh, laryngitis.
Laryngitis.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Chairman Morissette, honorable committee members, I'm Christy Bruce of Portland, Oregon, and I represent the David A. Nass Memorial Foundation. It's a member organization of the North American Brain Tumor Coalition. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Managers, thank you. Also, the Brain Activists, a grassroots group of brain tumor advocates, and my niece, a brain tumor survivor. I wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 191 and urge you to pass this important and non-controversial bill. I'm not a medical profession. I'm mostly here to give you the personal side. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my niece, brain tumor survivor Shannon O'Brien. Shannon is 35 years old. She lives in Tacoma. She's my sister's daughter. She's an 8-year brain tumor survivor, and she's a beautiful young woman, a former dancer, a former gymnast. Her brain tumor story began in 1994. She had, completely out of the blue, a grand mal seizure. She was rushed to the hospital. Tests followed. And my sister had to hear those chilling words that no parent ever wants to hear. Your daughter has a brain tumor. Shannon's tumor was huge, the size of a grapefruit. Her surgeon was able to remove 100% of the visible tumor. we learned that her tumor was a type called oligodendroglioma grade 2. That's low grade, considered benign. She had 6 weeks radiation follow-up treatment. After that, she enjoyed almost 6 years of tumor-free life, quarterly MRIs, four MRIs a year for 6 years with no recurrence. We began to breathe. We began to feel Shannon was home free, but it was not to be so. In 2000, Shannon's brain tumor came back. This time it had progressed to anaplastic oligodendroglioma grade 3, considered malignant. And the sad truth is, often benign brain tumors become malignant. Shannon had her second craniotomy, and again, her brilliant neurosurgeon was able to remove 100% of the visible tumor. I say the visible tumor because often it's the case, and in Shannon's case it was so, that there are microscopic tumor cells not visible on the scan that are infiltrating in healthy brain tissue. Shannon was no longer eligible for radiation. She had had a lifetime dose the first time around. So now her doctors and tumor board advised chemo to knock out the remaining infiltrated tumor cells. She completed 1 year of Temodar from October 2001. Her neurosurgeon, Dr. Alex Spence, allowed her to quit after 1 year, even though the trial protocol was for 2 years, because she suffered unusually severe side effects. Dr. Spence told Shannon he would watch her like a hawk. She is on an every other month MRI schedule, and she is eligible to resume Temodar treatment if she has another recurrence. I'm very pleased to be able to tell you that up to now, 15 months after Shannon stopped chemo, she has continued to have stable MRIs every 2 months for these 15 months with no treatment at all. Of course, we're very happy about that, but that doesn't mean Shannon is home free. She will probably need regular MRIs the rest of her life. She and her mom and all Shannon's loved ones have a cloud of worry hanging over us. Will it come back again? Will we lose our angel? And in the meantime, my beautiful niece Shannon is struggling with the deficits, the fatigue, the depression, cognitive and memory and pain problems resulting from the tumor and the treatments. Now, about the treatments. The state of the art of brain tumor treatments today is actually barbaric. And I didn't make that up. That comes straight from Dr. Keith Black, the head of neurosurgery from Cedars-Sinai. At a brain tumor conference Shannon and I attended, Dr. Keith Black, discussing current brain tumor treatments, said, "We cut them out, burn them out, and poison them out. All current brain tumor treatments are damaging to the brain. Survivors live with the deficits, cognitive difficulties, sensory impairment, difficulty with judgment and memory, lower energy levels, pain, for some seizures or loss of mobility, and that's not to mention the emotional strain of living with all this. On top of that, brain tumor treatments are not curative. All they do is buy time. Thousands of brain tumor patients, like my niece, are living in desperate hope that they'll live long enough for better treatments, or, dare we hope, a cure. The doctors and scientists who study brain tumors need many things in order to discover causes and cures. Of course, more money for research, but, and here's where this bill comes in, they need good information, complete information. At the present, cancer registries of most states, including Oregon, collect data on the malignant brain tumors only. Now, you might ask, well, why do we need to collect the benign data? After all, aren't these tumors benign? Well, it's not exactly true. When it comes to a tumor in the brain, something growing in your brain, the word benign has very little meaning. All brain tumors are potentially devastating. Some benign brain tumors become malignant. Brain tumor survival can be lower than for cancerous tumors. Benign brain tumor survival, excuse me. The survival for benign brain tumors can be lower. Women with meningioma, the most common benign brain tumor, have lower survival rates than women with breast cancer. There's a chart in the handout that shows that on page 2 of the attachments. The lower survival rate for benign brain cancer compared to for meningioma women compared to breast cancer women. On top of that, the existing data underestimates incidence rates of brain tumor by a factor of 2. And yes, you heard right, a benign brain tumor can become malignant. Not a lot of people realize this. Many do, and Shannon's did. This bill is non-controversial. A similar federal bill was enacted a few months ago. That was Senate Bill 2558, which on October 29 became Public Law Number 107260. The brain tumor community advocates were instrumental in helping pass that bill, and I'm here representing them in favor of Oregon's bill. This bill will ensure that Oregon law conforms with the new federal law, and I understand that the Oregon Cancer Registry has been planning this bill since long before the federal bill came into place. So Oregon will be ahead of the curve, will be a leader. Please, I urge you to support this bill and quickly move it through the legislative process. Brain tumor survivors and families and loved ones are holding our collective breath. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Doctor, would you please identify yourself?
Yes. Chairman Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Donald Austin. I'm a physician and a professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at OHSU. I'm also an associate director for the OHSU Cancer Institute, and I'm on the advisory committee for OHSU's, or I'm on the cancer committee for at OHSU, which oversees our institutional cancer registry, and I'm also on the advisory committee for the state cancer registry. And I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 191. I'll make this very brief. Like most of the larger hospitals in the state, we operate our own institutional registry. We already collect cancer data under the guidelines and, as here, the requirements of the American College of Surgeons, which is an accrediting body. About 80% of the cancer cases in the state are reported by hospital-based cancer registries. And because we are a referral center, the reporting requirement falls disproportionately on our shoulders. We've evaluated what this will take for us. And even though it may add about 10% to the total number of cases that we'll be reporting to the state registry, it does not significantly increase our total workload for the registry, and we believe we can accommodate that. We'll simply include those data in our report to the state cancer registry with our regular data, our data submissions. Regarding the other provision of the bill, our institutional pathology department already cooperates with the cancer registry, so there's not going to be any substantive change for us on that. We do, however, recognize that the seriousness of benign brain tumors and the fact that our cancer registry now is beginning to have its data, the state cancer registry is beginning to have its data used more and more in research, and we believe that this would be a valuable addition to data for research. OHSU pays very high regard to and priority on research, and therefore we support the provisions of SB 191. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Yes. Senator Fisher.
Doctor, could you describe a little bit the difference between actually benign and a cancer tumor? Do benign tumors metastasize?
No.
Obviously, in a small confined space, anything growing there that has ability to displace other material or cells or whatever the case may be is ultimately as life-threatening almost as one with one or the other. It depends almost on the rate of growth in that situation, I would think.
That's true. The ability, they're graded in different grades of tissue abnormality. And those that apparently do not metastasize and are less likely to invade are called benign, and they're graded depending upon how aggressive their cells appear. The more aggressive cells, the ones that we know from experience may metastasize or invade other tissues, are graded the higher grades, and those are reportable. And there are specific rules for the pathologists about how to grade these, and each cancer registry looks at those descriptions by the pathologist and decides if this is a reportable cancer or not. One of the unique things about benign brain tumors is that although they may appear benign and may be diagnosed as benign, they sometimes don't act as benign, because if you take them out, they'll come back again in a more aggressive cell type. I hope that's responsive to your question.
Yeah, I just was trying in my mind to see here, because the statement that it made brought it to my attention, although I thought about it several times before, because I've had two or three friends that had benign tumors that were life-threatening. And it wasn't, the word cancer wasn't even involved with it, but it was just as dangerous to their life and health. And so I was kind of wondering how they're graded with cancer, because it almost seemed to me like rate of growth was almost important whether it was cancerous or so-called benign.
Yeah, any expanding body within a closed cranium is dangerous to life. But these are graded based on how the cells look under the microscope.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. You're the chair.
Oh, yes. Senator Menas, I'm sorry.
Aye.
We have one more.
What?
Aye. I'm ready to vote.
Will you have one more person that you select?
So you want to
sort of throw him a ringer here and see what he does.
Our chair is absent.
Well, we're convinced about the...
Dr. Mel Cohn, we have one more person that wishes to testify here. How about this?
Gwyneth, did you perhaps sign up on the witness registration sheets to testify on Senate Bill 191?
Actually, I didn't sign up to testify deliberately for any of these two bills, because I was unaware of
them, so I
came today.
Okay.
I was aware of
the
things in the meeting after
them. Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. So you probably don't want to testify on 191, but just the after meeting. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mel, you really want this bill?
Yes, we do.
Then that's all you have to say.
Senator Morissette, I will be brief. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would be happy to move Senate Bill 191 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion to move Senate Bill 191 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Discussion.
Senator
Minnis?
Aye.
I'm sorry. Any? Senator Fisher, did you have a...
I was just going to tell Dr. Cohn that the vice chair was overruled.
Oh. Sorry, Mel. Okay. Any other discussion? Go ahead.
Okay. Senator Minnis?
Aye again.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Fine.
Motion.
Yes. Yeah.
I would move that we adopt this bill for the Senate Consent Calendar.
Okay. And we will adopt this. Any problem with the consent calendar that Senator Minnis will handle for us again? Okay, we'll go with the consent calendar, and Senator Minnis will have his name on it. Okay, next bill. One more.
I want to thank Ms. Grusoff for coming and convincing us of the need for this bill.
Thank you very much. I thank you. I will save your testimony. I will keep your testimony.
Thank you.
I appreciate
it.
Yeah, thank you. And you did very well. Thank you. Okay, Mickey Lansing, would you please? Okay, we're going to open the public hearing, and Mickey Lansing will.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, Senate Bill 158 includes the community learning centers as part of the services to children and families system.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I am here today to, in fact, support Senate Bill 158. The only thing that Senate Bill 158 actually does is align language that is in the statute, citing the Commission on Children and Families, and language that was in House Bill 2082 last session, which is, in fact, the particular statute, is 329.007, so that we are consistent in terms of what statute says about family resource centers and community learning centers. In 1993, House Bill 2004 was adopted by the legislature. Within that legislation, there were sightings around family resource centers and family service centers. Through the course of the years, family resource centers have been the dominant entity that local communities have used to have services, whether they be in schools or whether they be linked to schools, for parents and for their children. And historically, the kinds of services we've had in family resource centers or parent education classes, maybe child care, different learning environments, after school programs, mentoring, tutoring, those kinds of things. It was originally envisioned that family service centers were a more intensive way of having kids receive services like mental health, alcohol and drug, etc. What we know today is that the federal government has something called the 21st Century Community Learning Centers. The city of Portland and Multnomah County has something called Sun Schools, Schools Uniting Neighborhoods. In Salem, we have lighted schools. We have full-service schools. We have community schools, and we have family resource centers. We have had two major pieces of legislation, and we just wanted to make sure, both of them citing these kinds of efforts, that the language was consistent. So, with that, I am free to answer any questions.
Yes. It says that the bill may have some fiscal impact. Do you have any estimate?
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, the estimate we have is that there is no fiscal impact to this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that may be the case. I just haven't received the appropriate paperwork from legislative fiscal yet, so that's why I said may have fiscal impact, and I just didn't know it at the time.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, we have submitted a fiscal impact statement that said zero.
Okay.
Good. So. Your reputation is on the line there.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. That's the only testimony that we have this bill. So with that, we will close the public hearing and we will open a work session. Do I hear a motion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I move Senate Bill 158 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion to move Senate Bill 158 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, we will vote.
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, make the motion to put that on the consent calendar.
Okay, and the motion to put that on the put it on the consent calendar. No objection to that. Then we will put on the consent calendar, and the carrier will be Senator Walker.
Thank
Shouldn't
you.
Need a carrier for that.
I know.
Okay, so we have completed the
posted
agenda. I did make a statement earlier from the floor of the Senate that I would allow some testimony, realizing that in some ways this may not be according to the Senate rules because we didn't give 24-hour notice, but as long as I did say that, then I will be willing to stay here, and we will until 2:45. Members do not have to stay, but for those of you who are interested in hearing from constituents, I am willing to do this. So, Gwyneth, you did sign up on two different bills that have since passed. Okay, but I'd be very happy to hear your concerns.
Thanks, Bill. Senator Chair.
Okay. No, I just come up if you wish to speak, and I would like to, do a self-imposed limit in length so we can hear from as many people as possible. And we do have another committee hearing at 3, and I have to get out of here early in preparation for that. So we do have a half an hour to hear from those of you who wish to address.
I want to thank you, Mr. Chairperson, for letting us speak today and giving us this time. And I also want to apologize for interrupting your previous meeting because I'm unaware of the rules.
Gwyneth,
you guys are doing all these visual things back and forth and handing out paper that doesn't mean anything to me. And so, whatever.
Okay. Tell us your name and address.
Yes, I'm Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson. My address is 33030 Bloomberg Road, Eugene, Oregon, 97405. You're fast.
Okay.
And we are here because we want to get our concern about life-threatening cuts on everybody's agenda. Immediate top priority, because as you are all well aware, as of Saturday, people will have their oxygen withdrawn, et cetera, et cetera. You've heard lots and lots of testimony that's very disturbing to everyone. And so we want it to be top priority. What can be done about finding solutions? I think I understand that you in this committee are not in a position to raise revenue. Who is in a position to go through line items of detailed budgets to find out where else can be cut? Has that already been all done?
Well, Gwyneth, I believe that the administrative departments, the various departments, will look at that, and I think that is something that probably is happening as we speak, to see if there is indeed money available, and if there is, I guess a balance would have to be made about where the money is coming from. There are money in various accounts that simply is not available. I made a statement today that I thought it ought to be the rainy day fund, and the rainy day fund is constitutionally not available to use for this particular program. So I have very deep feelings, and I think we all do. I would like to find a replacement on a case-by-case basis. Even that raises another issue. Do we do a class? Do we all do all medical needy, or do we do a triage and try to deal with those who are at most at risk? And that is something that we have to look at very carefully. So that's... Now, as far as legislatively, I would not be surprised that... I don't know what's going to happen in the other committees. We have not had a chance to talk about this, Ways and Means Committee, the Revenue Committee. I would certainly welcome any other
So what role does this committee have that could, if you guys had your whole agenda to deal with these life-threatening cuts, what role could you play in solution finding? If that's all we had to talk about.
Well, I don't know, Gwyneth. We are a legislative committee to weigh legislative solutions. I don't know that we have the authority to direct departments to do anything at all. Fact-finding, we can make recommendations to other committees who... I don't know that we would have a bill before us that would raise... I don't know. Senator Minnis, do you want to help me out here?
Well, thank you, Senator Minnis.
I think that the the issues that are facing this legislature are going to be resolved by folks like yourself and others pointing out where the needs are. Because I think it's very clear that many times legislators understand the $32 billion plus state budget in a very, a very abstract way.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you're really engaged in a particular program, for instance, my bailiwick is criminal justice issues, mental health related to criminal justice issues. So a lot of legislators are not cognizant of where the real hurts and needs are, and so that's why advocacy groups help to bring to the attention of legislators what the impact of the loss of a program might be, or the reduction of a program. So I think that the good news for you, I think there's a high level of cognizance and an increasing level of cognizance among members who want to resolve these issues. But the issues are complex. And I think there's a desire, at least on my part, I spoke this on the floor today, that I do believe there's a need for us to deal with some of those critical issues of senior services, mental health, DD populations, medically needy, these kind of things. I think we ought to be doing that. But as the chair indicates, I don't have absolute control over the destiny or outcome of any one piece of legislation. I have to convince at least 16 members of the Senate and 31 members of the House, and the governor, quite frankly, plays a significant role in where we go with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as you've heard leadership talk about, not wanting to go back and making adjustments in the 2001-03 budget, many of us who are not in the leadership literally will follow what they're attempting to do to the degree that it's tolerable. But we do voice our opinions in hopes that we change even our own leadership's mind from time to time. And we do. So I guess the answer to your question is, and I do know that there are folks that are looking at the numbers, they're looking at where there can be adjustments made, and I think that we're trying to do this in a way that is not pointing fingers at each other and trying to resolve the issues. And I think the other thing we have to face is the 2005 budget is going to be a pretty difficult task, daunting task, particularly in light of Measure 28 failing and the attitude by and large of Oregon voters with respect to increasing their own taxes. So it's a very complex question, and I would just encourage you to continue your advocacy and do so respectfully and continue.
Thank you.
There are two sources that might be identified, and one of them, and I know the chair of the House Revenue Committee has been talking about a beer wine tax, whether or not that even gets a hearing is questionable. It hasn't in the past. Now, that wouldn't do any good immediately. That would not. Another source that has been identified are expenditures and tax credits, and again, that's not an immediate fix. But we're looking at various possibilities. Personally, I think at some point there will be a beer wine tax that the voters probably will have to deal with. But again, that's not something that we. But that money, I believe, would go to the alcohol, drug, mental health treatment areas rather than to the medical need that we're addressing. Senator Walker, did you have any?
Well, I see we've been joined by two others, and so I'd like to hear
some more
testimony. And
can I just ask another?
Okay.
Make one more comment. There are other people who would like to testify.
And,
yes.
We're, as I said, I'm going to close this in 20 minutes. So let's
okay.
try to deal with.
Okay. I won't talk for 20 minutes.
Concerns as possible.
I know you guys are bound by rules and regs and expectations and demands, and you're not paid very much. I'm glad to hear that.
Took a cut too, you know.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I do.
Right.
So I really do have respect for the position you're in, yeah, and the responsibilities that you bear. But, you know, what you said earlier about everything you learned in kindergarten,
mm-hmm,
we could cut through all this talk, and regulations,
yeah,
if we just basically remembered everything we learned in kindergarten is that we take care of each other. It is our responsibility to keep one another safe and to take care of each other. It's that simple. And as of Saturday, people will have oxygen withdrawn, etc. All those stories are nonetheless true, despite all of this talk. So we need solutions immediately.
Okay.
And you're not the governor. We've asked the governor to declare a moratorium on lethal cuts. We'll see how that goes. But it's just, let's cut through all the process, because the process has, you've spent a long time in emergency sessions dealing with the process, and now we're at a point where people are dying, and it's so easy for us to say, oh, I read about those things in the paper, and then just go home to our houses and not deal with it. We ought to have 24 hours a day summits dealing with this subject only until it's solved. And that's our opinion, and that's our position.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Glenn. Yes, would you identify yourself, please?
My name is Steve Weiss. I live at 2727 Southeast 16th Avenue in Portland, Oregon. I am, among other things, board president of the Mental Health Association of Oregon, vice chair of the Multnomah Disability Services Advisory Council, and board secretary of Independent Living Resources, which is the largest independent living center in Oregon. In a sense, I do advocacy work across the board on disability issues. There are a number of aspects of the budget cuts that have been made that trouble me, that probably haven't been talked about that much. The first is the loss of federal matching funds that accompany most of the cuts being made. This has not gotten a great deal of publicity, but the loss of those federal funds is devastating, and there's a serious question as to whether those funds could be restored at any time in the future. The other and wider problem is how much these budget cuts are going to cost the state of Oregon in the long run. The cuts to long-term care, particularly survival priority levels 10 to 17, and the cut to the medically needy program come to mind immediately in that regard. But what I'd like to concentrate on most is what the cuts are going to do to the mental health system in the state of Oregon. Last November 27th, Bob Nickel of the Mental Health and Addictions Division sent out a memo to a lot of folks essentially saying that if Measure 28 failed, it would be the last nail in the coffin on the decimation of the mental health and addiction system within the entire state. What that means is that on the mental health side, you're going to have a lot of people going into crisis as the result of the withdrawal of services. What will happen if they go into crisis is that they're going to need inpatient care. Emergency rooms will be flooded. There are already a lack of available beds across the state for people who are experiencing such severe mental health crises that they need inpatient hospital admission. We know from studies that have been done over the past 2 years that inpatient hospital utilization has been bleeding budgets in counties across the state. There isn't enough money for necessary outpatient care, and the lack of outpatient care, ironically enough, results in people going into crisis and needing more inpatient care. It's like a vicious circle and a catch-22 rolled into one. All of this will cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars and maybe more. On the medically needy program alone, there are a lot of people with mental health disabilities on that program who rely on it to pay for their medications. If the program is, as it almost certainly looks, going to be eliminated tomorrow, Those folks are going to have a great deal of time paying for their meds because most of them are on Social Security disability insurance and the low end, that is to say below the poverty level, which is currently $738 a month for a single person. There's just no money within that to pay for these necessary medications, many of which are extraordinarily expensive. So I hear a lot of talk about the legislature needing to stay within its means and needing to exercise fiscal restraint. One of the problems, and it may be a problem inherent in having a constitutional amendment that requires a balanced budget, is that without the flexibility to do anything about the certainty of these cuts costing the state huge amounts of money in the long run, we almost guarantee an endless cycle of fiscal crises with no end in sight. I'm not absolutely sure about everything that needs to be done. Frankly, I'd really rather have not seen the balanced budget amendment pass. I think it hamstrings legislators in ways that are very problematic and are really making themselves obvious now. Obviously, we need more revenue. If the medically needy program isn't saved in some way, and I know, Senator Morissette, you mentioned something in your speech out there about some plan that you had to at least deal with some of that. I don't know how viable that is or whether it's going anywhere, but it was music to my ears only because you mentioned it.
I wish that we had established a rainy day fund during good times, and we do have one that is dedicated constitutionally to education. Now, I was wishing that we could immediately do that. We can't. That I've found out since is not a possibility. But I guess I totally agree, and you have some interesting observations that I.
But and I'll make this my last comment. Gwyneth is right. What gets me, what weighs on my conscience, is that I know the terrible things that are going to happen to people, probably some of whom I know personally, and I feel helpless to actually do anything about it myself. And that's what's getting me. I'm waiting to hear bad news, and it's very difficult.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Jean Marie Moore, and do I need to give my street address or is my mailing address okay?
Yes.
Okay, 2852 Willamette Street, number 103, Eugene, Oregon.
Speak a little louder.
Speak a little louder. Okay. The thing that that I am curious about, because I've done my best to try to study these issues, are where does the money that the state has to fight lawsuits come from?
General fund and assessments across the agencies for non-general fund agencies.
General fund and assessments, and it would come across state agencies.
So potentially six lawsuits are already in process. And the state is going to be spending money, wasting it, in my opinion, big time wasting it, on that, when that money could resolve the issues and go to services. The only people that are going to benefit from this lawsuit stuff are the lawyers. I don't know whether to say that publicly or not, but that are the lawyers. And I feel really, and I also feel very confused and frankly not convinced that it looks to me, in terms of the publicity at least, like Human Services, Public Safety, Education, and Department of Human Services, like we've been talking about, are the place where the major cuts occurred. I'm not at all convinced, based on what has been printed and what I've been able to locate, that government-wide, underlined three times, cuts have not been applied. And I also feel very deeply, because I'm a therapist, I'm a licensed clinical social worker, that human life and investing in human life is what makes society what it is. It is what determines the quality of life for not just that person, but for everyone around. And it's ultimately a global thing, but right now we're talking about a state thing. And, you know, human life in a place where all I've heard about is pro-life, 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 it certainly seems that once there is a birth, then, you know, that person deserves a shot at making it. And there are many, 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 many things that are going to happen that Steve has outlined really well. And, you know, you guys are just going to end up wasting money dealing with these lawsuits. And I feel very disturbed about it as a taxpayer. I don't want it done in my name. And I'm just sure there are lots of other people that feel that way. And the other thing I would like to say, and I'm not meaning any disrespect, but I believe Measure 28 was written in a way, I mean, if Measure 28 had said, would you like 16,000 Oregonians to lose their services as of February and March 1st, and thereby increasing trips to emergency rooms, increasing crime, lessening your public safety, and diminishing your education, I don't believe most people would say, yeah, I want that, let's vote for that. I don't believe it. And I feel a lot of grief about how this bill was misrepresented and not explained. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I can assure you that there have been deep cuts in other areas of education. I know that Multnomah County, corrections in general, the court system and so on. But I think each person looks at it from their own perspective, and I know we've heard from the education community, we've heard from the court system, we've heard from areas that are experiencing cuts.
So with all due respect, those all have to do with investing in human life, making the quality of life better for everyone. Mm-hmm. No wonder you've heard from those people.
Yeah. Well,
I'm talking about, is the only thing that is in your budget public safety, education, and human services?
Pretty much.
It is the corpus of the general fund.
Human services and education make up the vast 80% of the budget. Thank you. Let's move along and go ahead.
Hi, my name is Amy Sackett, and I'm just a citizen. Uh-huh. I am with the SOS Coalition, but I am one of those people that have alliance. I'm sorry. I am one of the people that have already been cut. I will be cut as of Saturday. And I know you guys are all working, and I'm not going to get into the same things they've gotten into. But when I walked in today, one of the main concerns I have as a mental health consumer is I saw that the suggestion makeup of mental health advisory board members. There's nine state employees, et cetera, et cetera, and you have three consumers. Isn't it time that maybe a consumer board was put together to report to some of these people so that the real people that are living through this have a say and can tell you our stories from our side, what it's like, what helps us, what we see, what we would want in a society. I come from Wisconsin, and we had a Blue Ribbon Commission that the governor met with once a month, and they were all mental health consumers, and they all worked together because I know this is going to be a long term, and we all need to work together. But I also believe that more than three consumers needs to be put on here. And also, there was a packet you will find in your mailbox that Friendship Post, which is a day drop-in center here in Salem put together, and they are stories of people that are affected, and this is an act of consumers trying to empower and get out the stories of other consumers. So I just ask that you take those two things into consideration. Get more consumers on the board and come and talk to us and not just have us as a number, and to look and come and visit and see what the consumers' concerns are and their inputs are before you make any decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll suggest that to the governor. I will carry that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Rick Berger, and that's spelled without a K. That's R-I-C. I live at 1741 Southeast 113th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. I think what my colleagues and friends have said, come before me and said, I could not say any better. I'm actually going to touch on two things. The first is an actual suggestion about the budget. I, like Steve and Jan and Laura, who's behind me, am a member of the Disability Services Advisory Council in Multnomah County. Jim McConnell, who is the director of Aging and Disability Services for Multnomah County, came to our last meeting, which was this past Monday, to talk about the layoffs that he was going to have to make within the agency. Amongst that list of layoffs were four positions that were assigned to a veterans benefits counseling program that had been receiving money from the had been funded by the state. The state had said that it was no longer willing to fund this program. The problem here is, and this is a perfect example, I think, of what's wrong, I think, at the state administrative level, is that program has saved the state countless Medicaid dollars, in that it helps veterans to find benefits that they can get at the federal level that they are entitled to under their veteran status, which means the state does not have to spend Medicaid dollars on those benefits for them. These are benefits that they're entitled to under the Veterans Affairs system. It's to cut this program that obviously saves the state money, to me, is ludicrous. And how they, can defend that, I don't know. And that's all I'll say on that. If you want more information on that, I'm sure that Mr. McConnell can give you more information. He's the director at Multnomah County Aging and Disability Services. Now I'm going to get a little bit more personal. I am a person who receives services as well in the community. I receive services under Oregon's long-term care waiver. I live in an adult care home. In the last month, I've watched the stuff that has come out of DHS over what will be cut. I have watched the cuts say that I would not get services anymore. I've watched them say I would get services. I've seen them say I wouldn't get services. The situation has been very fluid coming out of DHS. It's been hard to guess exactly what's going to happen. I'm still not taking anything for granted. And I know I've said this throughout the last day, 2 days. I don't think I can say it enough. That in and of itself is very traumatic. To not know, to hear that this might happen to you, this might not happen. A good friend of mine, Laddie Reed, has also had the same problem. He's gone through the same thing. This is the third legislative session I've had the privilege to come and be an advocate at. In the 99 session, I watched as cuts were made to human services. Certainly none of these cuts were as severe as the cuts that we're facing now. but nonetheless watch cuts made. 99 was, by the way, we were still technically in, in an economic boom at that time, and certainly doing very well. I watched cuts made in the 2001 session, when things may not have been as good, but were still probably pretty decent. And I watched these cuts made, so in my opinion, that corporations like Nike and Intel could get tax breaks. And when times were okay and they thought, well, we need to give these tax breaks to people, it's okay to make cuts. Times are bad, we really need to make cuts to our services. When isn't it appropriate to make cuts to our services? I just like to know. I've been watching for the last 3 years cuts made. Maybe not as bad as we're facing now, but nonetheless watching cuts made in essential services. And, you know, we are here because we need to draw the line. Obviously, nobody else is going to draw the line for us except us. And that's why we are here. And that's why we're here with the voice that we have right now. I was arrested. I was one of those who was arrested last night. And, you know, I did it. I was here and I took that stand because, frankly, you know, I can't, you know, I'm all used up with any other way to do this. We need to take a stand. You need to understand. This is our lives that you're dealing with here. Our lives. And we feel like we're being played. We really do. From the point of view of somebody who receives services, who's had to face this, who's talked with friends, who are also facing this, and they've talked to me and said, what can we do, and what's going to happen? And the best I can say is, I don't know what's going to happen. It looks bad. It really does. People are already dying. You've got to do something. You have to do something. You know, I know you can say, we're our hands are tied by the rules. You know, we can only do so much. You have to do something.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Wait a minute. Go ahead.
My name is Madeline Smith. I live at 594 West 11th Avenue, Eugene, Oregon, 97401. And I'm going to be very brief. At present, Consumer is on the Mental Health Advisory Board, and the recommendation I'm going to make is that some consumers, I don't know how many, be on the Mental Health Policy Board so that they are directly where the decisions are made rather than making suggestions. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I promise I'll make it short. My name is Laura Woodruff. I live at 6705 North Seneca Street in Portland. Frank Alita says hi. I'd like to tell you a story about a disabled woman. She's 82 years old. She's just been released from a nursing home to a foster home. She'll be evicted on March 1st. She doesn't know what she's going to do. Another person that I know is a young man that had an injury in mid-December, and he has no income now and no way to pay his rent. And without the general assistance program, he is out on the streets and will wind up living under a bridge or move into a garage somewhere so as to not to intrude on anybody's life. I wear a button here that says, in poverty, give me $10. It started out as a joke because I felt poor because I live on a very small disability income, but now it's serious, and I feel very blessed that I have a home and I have money to pay my bills and my groceries, and I wish everyone else were as lucky as I am. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you very much for your participation, and as time goes on, I will set time aside during this committee for public testimony, and it will be put on the agenda so you will know ahead of time that there will be some time set aside, because I think we need to hear from you on an ongoing basis. It isn't, you know, just when times are at their worst. We need continued input. So thank you very much for being here, and we will
Mr. Chair?
Yes, yes.
I had my staff go into our committee services book to bring me some information on where the budget money goes, and I can leave these here. It looks like I only have page 1 of 5, so if someone wants more than that, we can get that out of my office. But it does tell you that over 56% of the state's general fund and lottery fund expenditures are directed to education programs, and almost 90% of the general fund and lottery fund goes to three major programs: education, human services, and public safety. So when you're talking about making budget cuts, when these programs make up 90% of the budget, it's pretty hard to stay away from those programs. So I'll leave this here at the table so you can pick this up if you like.
Okay. Gwen, just a minute. I have to apologize for not recognizing Senator Shields. I didn't know that he was wanted to speak before I left. Rick Berger, he is your senator, I believe. Frank Shields is who's senator? Raise your hand if he's your senator. Okay, good. I think Senator Shields wanted to acknowledge your presence and thank you for being here, and I didn't have an opportunity to recognize him before he had to leave. Any other comments? Okay, good. Thank you again. Thank you.
Are you going to
have a brief comment? And that is, I wish there'd be a resolution asking on behalf of Oregon and all other states for federal revenue sharing. It wouldn't cost a penny. It would cost just printing for Oregon to do that. But it's very clear there are 40 states that are in deficit, and certainly the Democrats are always begging for some response on
it. Okay, now tell us your name, please. Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Jerry Smith from Eugene.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Okay, and with that, we will close the committee hearing. Thank you. Margie, hit me hard when somebody wants to.
Hi. Yes, hi. Thanks for your comment.
No, don't try to be discreet when I didn't understand what you were saying. He said that he was, but I didn't know.
Yeah, because he
is what? I'm sorry. Okay.
No. I want you to be sure to let me
right.
know.
Good.
Nag me.
You got it.
Good. Yes. Gwyneth. Yes.
So, give a moment. So,